Check, check, check. We'll get started in just a minute. If there are any ISVs here, Scott spoke about the Front Runner program. I have a few business cards. I'll keep them here. You can come collect them during a break. But we'll be providing marketing and technical support. If you're an ISV and interested in building out a Windows Azure application, Microsoft can go hand in hand with you. So please do come collect a business card during a break, or raise your hand, I could come get them to you. Now we'll get Brad Calder started. He'll talk about Azure Data Storage. Brad, it's all yours.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Thanks.
Mic on?
Do you want?
Okay. Nope. Better now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why is this not playing?
Check, check.
Okay.
Can you turn the volume up, I guess? Okay, my name is Brad Calder, and I'll be talking about Windows Azure Storage, and we're going to talk about the data abstractions Windows Azure Storage provides, as well as how do you use those with our storage client library to build your applications.
Thanks.
So Windows Azure Storage provides a service in the cloud that allows you to build for your applications and have your developers access this vast amount of storage we are providing in the cloud. It's scalable, durable, available, anywhere at any time access, and it's provided as a utility-based service. So you basically only have to pay for what you use and store. Now, we provide access to some fundamental data abstractions in terms of blobs, tables, and queues. And these are provided with very easy-to-use REST interfaces, as well as a supported storage client library. And recently, we provided access to also a durable drive. So your existing Windows Azure applications can mount a durable drive over the network and use their existing NTFS APIs to help to deal with failures for your application. Now, just to highlight these data abstractions before we go into them in detail, we'll be talking about blobs, drives, tables, and queues in this order. Blobs provide your interface for storing files into the cloud, along with metadata with those files. Drives, as I mentioned, allow your Windows Azure applications to mount this network-attached durable drive. Tables provide access to structured storage, so you can store for your table a set of entities, and in those a set of properties, and then query over those entities and properties. Then queues provide a reliable way for your applications to deliver messages from one set of roles to another set of roles for workflow. Now, before you can actually use these data abstractions, the first thing you need to do is go to the Windows Azure Developer Portal and create a storage account. You can actually create multiple storage accounts. So when you create a storage account, you create a globally unique storage account name. And when you create that, you can actually specify which geolocation you want your storage account held in. So here we show that we have access to six regions across the globe. So you have two in the US, two in Europe, and two in Asia. Okay? So when you create your storage account, you specify which geolocation you want that storage account to be hosted in. And what this means is that whenever you go to do an access to your storage account, so for example, if you chose the US North as your geolocation, all your requests would go to US North data center, and then the request would be served from there. So even if the request is coming from Europe or some other place. Now, one of the things you can do with your storage accounts along with your computation is you can affinitize them. So when you create your actual compute service, you can actually also choose the same geolocation that you actually chose for your storage account. And you want to do that for a variety of reasons. One obvious reason is that it gives you better connectivity and lower latency between your compute and storage, as well as the bandwidth between compute and storage in the same geolocation is free. Now, when you create your storage account, you get back a 512-bit secret key. And then you use that secret key to basically sign each of your requests to this storage service. So you basically take the request, create a signature for that specific request, you send with that request to the storage service, not your key, but that signature, and then we validate the signature on the storage service to make sure that it's a valid authenticated request. Okay. So let's dive into blobs. Here we have the data abstractions for blobs. We created our storage account. Now, with our storage account, inside of there, we can create one-to-many blob containers. And then all the blobs, or basically the files you store into the cloud, have to be stored within a container. So here we have a storage account called Coho Winery. Then we have our containers images. Let's say we want to put some images up there for our website as well as some videos. And then we'll store our blobs, our pictures and videos into these containers. Now, the containers provide a level of sharing policies for the blobs within the container. So what you can do is you can specify that all the blobs within this container are to be private. That means that only authenticated requests from the account owner who knows the secret key can access those blobs by passing in those signatures. You can also specify that all the blobs within this container are to be public. That means that if anybody knows the URL, anybody can access the blob. You can also specify additional policies like creating signed signatures, which I'll get into in a few slides. Now, since the underlying protocol here is actually REST, shown here is the REST protocol for actually accessing the storage account for blobs, containers, and the blob name. So when you actually create a call to the storage service, you know, this formation of this URL is made simple with our client library. But if you look at the REST interface, you'll see this request coming along. And you first specify your storage account, then you specify the keyword blob, and that basically directs this request to our blob service, and via what storage account you have, it'll direct it to the correct geolocation. So let's say if we had US North, this request will be directed to US North data center. Then after this, you have the container name, and there are no slashes that are allowed in the container name. Then the rest of the URL is the blob name, and that can have slashes in it. So diving into the interfaces we provide for our files, or basically blobs, we allow you to obviously store files, store your blobs. We also allow you to update the blob. So you can actually change just part of the blob contents. If you actually want to modify the blob, you don't have to re-upload the whole blob again. You can also get the blob in terms of getting the whole blob or just getting a range of the blob. You can delete the blob, copy the blob within a storage account, and you can also snapshot a blob. Now, with snapshot, what that means is you can actually create backup versions of your blobs. So you can actually have a blob that you're updating, and you can create a snapshot in time, then make some more updates, create another snapshot, create some more updates, create another snapshot. So you have these different versions of your blob. And the nice thing about this is that for our storage service, you're only charged for the delta differences between the base version of the blob and those delta differences. So you're not charged for every single full copy. And finally, we have provided the ability to get an exclusive right lease on a blob. So you can get an exclusive right lease, and then you can keep on renewing that lease to maintain exclusive right access. Some applications use this to basically, you know, maintain exclusive right access to a blob for concurrency. Other applications are looking at using this for other things like leader election. So maybe you might have a service, and you actually want to have something that does leader election for it, you know, if you have a master of your service. So you could actually use the lease blob to maintain a lease to determine who's the leader or who's the master. Now, in terms of the metadata you can associate with a blob, we support a lot of the standard HTTP metadata, which like shown here, like cache control, content encoding, content type, and there's more. And you can also specify your own metadata in terms of name value pairs, and you can get and set this metadata separately from the blob itself. Okay, so let's dive into using the storage client library to actually upload and download a file, just to show how that's done. So shown here, we create a storage credentials account object. Now, this is provided with the Windows Azure SDK. And you specify here your account name and your secret key. And then with this credential object, along with the base URL for accessing your storage account, you can create a Cloud Blob client object. Okay, so here we have our, you know, the base URL is our account name, blob.core.windows.net. Okay, now with this base client object, we can do all of our requests to our blob service for this storage account because it knows the account and key. So let's say the next thing we want to do is we have our storage account and we actually want to put some blobs up into there. So the first thing we have to do is we have to have a container because all blobs are stored within a container. So we would take the Cloud Blob client object, and then we get a reference for that to create a container object specifying the container name. So specifying the container name, we get a container object. And then we can just say, well, create the container if it doesn't exist. And then when you execute this command here, this will actually go to the store, the blob service, and then create the container if it doesn't exist. Then let's put a blob up into that container. Well, first we need to actually drive a blob object, and we specify, use the container object, and we specify the blob name to get a reference to that. This will create a container object for us, a blob object for us. And then we're going to put this, basically upload this into the cloud. Now, one thing you can do when you actually upload a blob is you can also specify what's called blob request options. There's a lot of options you can actually specify there, such as retry policies, what's the timeout you want for the blob, etc. In this example, I'll just use the default. Then I can take that blob object and I can say upload this file, passing into it a local file name along with those default options. And you know, this object knows what where to store it because we have specified our storage account and the credentials as well as the container name to derive the container object and the blob name. Okay? Then you can also similarly download a blob from the object from the cloud by specifying a blob object with a name. And then you can say download the file, specifying the local file, and then that gives you the downloaded blob to that local file on your local machine or on your machine in the cloud. Okay. So now I want to dive into a little bit under the hood of what's going on for the blobs. We actually support two types of blobs. The first is called block blobs. And these are the type of blobs we actually introduced originally at PDC 2008. These are targeted at streaming workloads. Here, each blob actually consists of a sequence, or you can think of it as a list of blocks. Okay? You basically upload these blocks into an uncommitted region for a blob, and then you commit them. And we'll go through an example of how that works. So it has this sort of two-phase update semantics. And then the blob size for block blobs can be up to 200 gigabytes in size. The other type of blob is called the page blob. This is what we introduced at PDC 2009. This is targeted at random read-write workloads. In particular, this provides, you know, fast random writes. So each blob consists of an array of pages, or you think of it as an index of pages, and you can randomly write into there a range of pages where a range can be up to 4 megabytes in size. Okay? And the size limit for this type of blob is up to 1 terabyte. So let's just go through a couple quick examples. So we're going to first start with block blobs. And we want to upload, in this example, my favorite movie, the blob, and we're going to basically specify here the blob name that we actually want to store into the cloud, and then we're going to store, we're going to take this movie and we're going to break it up into blocks. Every single block has a unique ID that's scoped by the blob name, okay? So we're going to put these blocks up into the cloud and have them associated with this blob as effectively what we call uncommitted blocks. So we can do a put block here, where we specify the blob name, the block ID, and the block bits. And each of these blocks that we put up there, you can't read them yet because they're not committed. They're basically sitting there associated with the blob. What this allows you to do is upload a bunch of different changes and then commit them all at once to be a new readable version of the blob. And then notice that block 3 here is actually a different size than the other blocks. So all the blocks actually don't have to be the same size. They can actually be different sizes. So we're going to upload block ID 3. And eventually, we're going to be done. We're going to have uploaded all of our blocks. Okay? Then once we've actually uploaded all the changes we want to do for this blob, we then do what we call a put block list. This effectively commits all these blocks to be the new readable version of the blob. And so if you look at the put block list, you'll see block ID 1, block ID 2, etc., all the way to block ID N. Now, when this command executes, once it's done, we'll actually have a readable version of the blob that basically consists of all those blocks in that order. So if I was to read the blob from the beginning to the end, I'd see the contents of block ID 1, then block ID 2, all the way to block ID N. Okay? Now, what this interface, I don't have time to go into the detail in this talk, it provides a lot of additional benefits. One is, it allows you to upload the blob via the blocks and to do any type of modification effectively in terms of blocks. You can basically insert blocks into the blob, you can delete blocks into from an existing blob, and you can actually even rearrange the blocks for an existing blob. You know, not that many people using that functionality, but it's there. Okay? And what really matters is that when you do the commit with a put block list, is the list of blocks in that order to be the readable version of the blob. Now, question?
or account limit on the number of blocks?
Good question. So the question was, is there a size and count limit on the number of blocks? The size limit is a block can be up to 4 megabytes in size, and then you can store right now up to 50,000 blocks for a given blob, committed blocks. And hence, you multiply those out, that gives you the 200 gigabyte size limit.
If it fails, does it automatically roll back, or you had a shot at the rollback?
If the commit fails, the question is, what happens when if the commit fails? If the commit fails, the blob actually doesn't change at all, and those blocks are just sitting there still in the uncommitted list. One thing I glossed over here, there's more details in some other talks, is that when you do a commit, all of those temporary blocks that you use as part of the commit become part of the readable version of the blob, and they're no longer part of the uncommitted list. Okay, so they're basically removed from there. But did that answer your question? Okay. Okay. So in terms of uploading blocks, and a few nice things that this provides you is that if you actually have to store a very large blob and you get a connection failure in the middle, you don't have to start from the beginning. It provides efficient continuation and retry because you can actually try to retry and commit, upload each block separately. In addition, you can even upload the blocks out of order and parallel. And what matters is the order of the blocks in that put block list in terms of creating the new readable version of the blob. Okay. Then in terms of page blobs, the focus here is really at creating efficient random read and write workloads for a blob. And when you use a page blob, the very first thing you do is you actually create the blob by specifying the blob size. So you say, I want to create this blob with this blob name, and you specify the size that you want to create. In this example, we chose 10 gigabytes. And you can sort of, once the creation is done, you can sort of imagine that you have this blob in the storage service, and it's initialized 10 gigabytes to zero. Okay? So these pages that actually aren't stored are basically initialized so that you can actually read them, and you just get zeros back. Now, the blob size itself, or the page size, is set to be 512 bytes. Okay? What this means is that when you actually update the blob, the page blob, all your updates have to be 512 byte aligned. But you can actually read from any byte offset. So it's a restriction basically for just updating. Now, let's go just do an example. So let's say we want to do some updates here. So we're going to do a put page of these three pages. So you can actually put a range of pages up to 4 megabytes in size. So a range put can be up to 4 megabytes. Let's do another one here. And we can do another one, which actually will clear the pages. So if I actually want to delete pages, we have an operation which says clear pages. And what this does is it will remove that content so that you're not charged for it. And when you do a clear pages, these pages are effectively thought to be zero. So one of the key aspects here, let's do another put page, is that for this type of blob, you're only charged for the pages that actually have data stored in here. So even though we have allocated a 10 gigabyte blob, we're only charged for the three pages that are stored here. So you can create actually a 1 terabyte blob, but you're only charged for the pages that you actually store. Okay? Now, because you might have a sparsely populated blob, we provide an interface that allows you to get what are the populated ranges. And this is basically very useful for when basically uploading or downloading your blob. Because if you have a very sparsely populated blob, basically what you want to do is just download or upload those used pages. So you can do what's called a get page range, and this gives you back the ranges of valid pages. And then you can actually you can download those pages via get blob and just download those page ranges. Now in this example, I'm actually downloading, I'm starting at byte 1000, and note that it actually starts at a page range where there's actually no data stored. And as I mentioned, you will return zeros for those first 536 bytes for this example, and then the data in the orange page after that.
Defrag our blobs?
Question is, do we have to defrag our blobs? It depends on how you actually want to use them. So here, you're actually only charged for those three pages in this example. So in terms of what you're being charged, you don't have to do any defragmentation at all. We deal with all the garbage collection and that type of stuff in the background in our blob service. Answer your question? Okay. Okay. Now, one scenario I actually want to dive into a little bit is using the Windows Azure CDN for basically accessing your blobs. You know, the scenario we're focusing on here is that you may have frequently accessed blobs, and those blobs may be accessed, you know, from users around the world. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, your storage account is allocated in a given geolocation. And so somebody, let's say we choose that geolocation to be US North. If somebody from Europe is accessing that storage account, then they're going all the way to US North to basically get access to those blobs. But maybe you have very popular content that you actually want to deliver from around the world, and you don't actually have to pay for that latency. You actually don't have the latency for your users. So what you can use is use our Windows Azure CDN, and what this will do is that we'll actually cache the blobs that are used in our edge network, where we have 18 locations around the world. So, for example, going back to our example with the user in Europe, basically the blob would be potentially cached in Europe, and then you get the high connectivity and low latency of getting access to that edge location. So the benefit here is that you get better user interaction, or the user gets better access to the data, even though they're far from where the blob storage service is actually allocated to, the geolocation, and it provides very high bandwidth and content delivery for popular events. So just going through a quick example of how to do this, this is integrated with our blobs via the Windows Azure Developer Portal. So you can go to the Windows Azure Developer Portal, and you can enable for your storage account to use CDN. You just go in and you click Enable. And you get back a domain name, which you can then use to access your blobs. So you'll get back a domain name that looks like this, an id.vo.msncdn.net. Now, you might not want to use that to access your blobs, so you're also allowed to register a custom domain name to access the blobs via CDN. Now, note that this is actually different than the base domain name you use for accessing your storage account, which is shown here. So if you use the last URL shown here, that will actually go to the blob service where it's located and get the blob. If you use any of the other two URLs, then it'll actually go to the CDN network and then retrieve the blob via the CDN. So how does that work? Well, how to use this? So what you want to do is for these blobs that you want to make publicly accessible via the CDN, you can specify the cache control policy for those blobs. And what this does is it specifies a time to live for the blobs. And that means how long will those blobs actually live in the cache network before they're refreshed. Then you want to make the blobs publicly available. So you actually make the containers for the blobs publicly accessible. So those blobs are now publicly accessible. And then you reference those blobs via however you're going to distribute access to them via one of those first two URLs. Then when somebody uses that URL, basically the request is routed to our via Anycast IP to the closest edge network. The edge will see if the blob's cached there. If not, it will retrieve it from your storage account, because it's publicly accessible, and cache it there for the time to live you specified for the blob. Okay? So on a miss, or a time to live expiration, it'll retrieve the blob into the CDN. And then we'll just be serving that blob up from the CDN to give, you know, better experience to your end users for accessing the content. Okay.
That data is publicly available. Could someone go and scrape that data out of you guys' cache network?
Somebody can access the blob if they know the corresponding URL. But they have to know the corresponding URL or have a way to basically derive that to get access to the blob. The question was, can somebody scrape or find the content? And you basically have to know the URLs that are going to be accessed and then try to enumerate randomly over there to find out what the blob names are. Okay. Now, the last thing I want to actually talk about question?
Can you update the blob content? Can you force it to refresh on the CDN side?
Right now, there's not a mandatory ability to. The question was, can we proactively tell when we update the blob to basically update also the cache? And there's not that feature right now. It's being looked in because there's a feature request, but we don't have any commitment to it at this time. What you could do is actually specify a lower time to live, lower TTL for your blob, so that basically it's refreshed more often. But that's a feature request that we've had. It's just TTL. The question was, how do we, any other way to validate the cache, and it's via TTL at this time. Another request we've had is basically being able to provide access with signed URLs via the CDN. And I'll talk about signed URLs right now. So the feature here is that you may want to actually give out access to your blobs, but you don't want to make them public, and you don't want to give out your secret key. So what you can do is you can create what's typically called a signed URL. So here we have a blob here that we want to give access to, but you know, we don't want to give out our secret key or make it public. So we can create what we call a SAS, which is a signature that you can give out to give signed access, time-based access to this blob. So with this, you can specify a few things. You can specify what's the time range for the blob to get access to. So what's the start time and end time? You can also specify what resource granularity you want to give access to. Container means you're going to give access to all the blobs in this container. Blob means you're giving access to just this specific pick one, whereas container means give access to all of the blobs in the images container. And you can also specify the type of resource level access you want to give. Do you want to give read, write, delete, or a combination of these? So in this example, we gave read, write access to this container. Okay. So what you do is you use your secret key to take this URL as well as this time, resource, and permission information, and you create a signature with that. Okay? And then you can give out this URL with this signature, and then we validate that at the blob service. Okay? And then, so you don't have to give out your secret key, and you can give out this time-based access. Now, there's a few advanced topics I don't have time to go into, but I'll just really quickly summarize them. That's using a signed identifier. You can also register with your storage container what's called a signed identifier. And what you do here is you actually give it whatever name you want. Here we gave it foo. And this signed identifier is actually stored with that container images. Okay? Now, when you use a signed identifier, you use that as part of the canonicalization when creating this signature. Okay? So the signature has to have the signed identifier stored in that images container for it to be valid. So this allows you to instantaneously revoke access to this signature by just removing that signed identifier from your container. In addition, it allows you to do a couple other things. It allows you to actually store the time range as well as the permissions with your signed identifier in the container. So then your URL would look like this. So that basically cleans up your URL a little bit. In addition, since the time and the permissions are stored with the signed identifier, you can actually change them on the fly, and the signature is still valid. So I could actually change the time period, or I could change the permissions. It was read-write. I can actually remove the write access, and the signature is still valid. So it gives you a little bit more advanced features for controlling the access and the long, basically how long that somebody can use the signature or before you revoke it. Okay. So in terms of summarizing blobs, we want to provide blobs with these two access patterns for streaming-based blobs as well as random read writes. And the blob operations I talked about, don't have time to go into all in the details for all these, but copy, snapshot, and lease give you some rich operations for manipulating your blobs. And then I talked about using the content delivery network, signed URLs, and I sort of touched on custom domain names, but didn't have time to go into them. You can actually register a custom domain name for your standard, account blob core windows.net, because not everybody wants to use that URL for accessing your blob, so you can actually create your and register your own domain name there, as well as for accessing the content delivery network. Okay. So that's basically summarizes for blobs. Now I'll move on to drives. Okay. So for drives, this provides the ability for your application to access a network-attached durable drive. Okay, so you can use existing NTFS APIs to basically access that drive. Now, the couple benefits for why we created this are as follows. One is we wanted to make it easier for existing applications to be able to migrate to the cloud. And if you're trying to use this drive, if your application fails over or if there's a hardware failure, since you're actually reading and writing from a network-attached drive, basically the data survives if there's a failure. Okay. It gives you the durability for your data. Now, under the covers, what a drive is actually a page blob. So you actually are attaching to your Windows Azure application a page blob. And so you mount this page blob over the network, and then all flushed and unbuffered writes are made durable to that blob. So when you use a page blob in this manner, what is it? Well, it's actually a formatted single volume NTFS VHD. And these drives can be up to 1 terabyte in size, which is the same size as the page blob. And a page blob can only be mounted for read-write access by one VM instance at a time. Okay? But a VM instance can actually mount up to 16 drives. And one of the nice features here is that since the drives are actually page blobs, you can use the page blob interface to upload your VHDs or download your VHDs from the cloud. Let's just go through a quick example of how this works. So assume we have a formatted page blob that we've already uploaded into the cloud called Demo Blob. This is an NTFS VHD formatted page blob. And we have our Windows Azure VM application we want to run in the cloud. So we want to mount this and be able to use this to use it as a NTFS drive. So the first thing we do with our application is we call this mount command to mount the blob. What this will do is it'll cause the driver in our OS to basically go to the blob service and get a lease for that blob. If it can get a lease for the blob, it then creates the drive letter that the application can then use to basically use this as a durable drive. Now, another thing you do when you actually use drives is you actually specify how much of the local disk space for your VM instance do you actually want to use as a cache for your drive. You could actually specify, you know, zero. You actually don't have to use any local disk space for this drive that you mounted. Or you can, you know, specify up to the drive size. Now, when you actually do your writes to this drive, all the writes are made durable to the drive in the cloud, the page blob, before success is returned back to the client. That's what guarantees the durability of your drive. Then also, if the data is located in the cache, the data will be updated there. So when you do a read, we'll first look in the cache. If the data is there, we'll then return that to the application. But if it's a miss, we'll retrieve it from the page blob in the blob service, return it to the application, and update the cache. So on a subsequent read, we can get hit in the cache, return to the application, and we don't have to basically go to the blob service to, you know, get the data for the read. Okay. So now I want to give a quick example of using our storage client library to mount a drive and access a drive. Now, the first thing you need to do when using drives is you need to create what's called a local resource to specify how much disk space you want to use for your local VM for caching your drives for that VM. So this disk space will actually be used for that local resource across all of these potential VM drives that you want to mount for the VM. Then you pass into the cloud drive object provided with our SDK the directory for that local resource, as well as how much size you actually want to reserve for the cache for the cloud drive. Okay? Then you need to create a storage account object. This is another way, another alternative to what I showed earlier in terms of you're registering your storage account with your secret key. You can actually create in the web and worker roles, it has a nice configuration option to say create a configuration settings and create a storage account, specify your storage account key, and then you can create a storage account object with using from configuration settings as shown here. So now we have our storage account object, we can actually now manipulate the drives. We can create a drive object. So we take our storage account object and say create the cloud drive specifying the page blob URI. Okay, this is the URI where you have the container name and blob name. Once we have that drive object, we can now manipulate that drive via the page blob. So as I mentioned, you can actually upload VHDs into the cloud to get the drives there. You can also create a drive via your cloud application by just saying drive.create and specify the size in megabytes. And what the create does, it'll actually, you know, create the page blob and then format it to be a single NTFS VHD. Now, once we have a drive up there, either we uploaded it or created it, we can then say, take our drive object and then say mount, specifying how much of the local disk space do we want to do for caching this specific drive that we're mounting, along with some drive mount options, which I don't have time to go into. But typically, users will use the default options. Okay? What this will do is what I just showed on the prior slide. It'll try to go get the lease, and once it's mounted, it returns the drive letter shown here as a string. You can then access this as any normal drive, NTFS drive, for your application to use. So you can do your existing NTFS writes. And one feature that you can use, which actually is tied into blob snapshots, is you can say snapshot drive. So you can actually use the drive and you can say snapshot, then create another snapshot. And then what this is doing is it's actually creating snapshot blobs, which are basically snapshot drives. So you can actually create backups of your drives using the snapshot feature this way. And then once you're done using the drive, you can say unmount, and it's unmounted. This is basically all you need to do to basically use the drives with your Windows Azure application. Okay. So in summary, one thing I want to make clear is that this driver that we have to basically do this mounting of drives and this redirection to use a network-attached durable drive, this driver is only available right now in the cloud. So you can only do this mounting, et cetera, of the page blobs in the cloud to your Windows Azure applications in the cloud. You can't do that locally. If you want to use the VHDs locally, you would download them, mount them locally, look at them, et cetera. As I mentioned, the page blob can only be mounted by one VM instance at a time for read-write access. But the snapshots provide a nice, interesting feature in that with a snapshot, you can actually mount a single snapshot to multiple roles at a time. So you could actually have a drive that you're popping with some data. Let's say you want to serve that data up via a web service with some static content. So you could actually create a snapshot and then have that snapshot mounted by N web roles and have that serve up that content. Okay. So that summarizes drives. Now I want to move on to tables. Question?
So by VM, do you mean a single role? So is that a single worker role, or is that an application that has potentially a worker role and a web role?
By VM, I actually mean a single VM instance. So you could actually have, let's say, a worker role there, but it could actually be running multiple processes. Okay? So basically it's tied to that VM instance, not tied necessarily directly to that role or that single process. Okay. The question is, can you change the cache size of a mounted drive after mounting? And the question is, yes. Right now the drive is in beta, so we're still defining the exact semantics of that in terms of what that means, but you can do that. Yep.
The drive, you can associate that with a blob. So, for example, I can upload blobs and then put those into a drive and assign that drive to a particular user, perhaps, to use a drive as a way to control access.
So the question was a scenario around basically providing access to users in terms of page blobs via the drives.
Yeah.
So just to reiterate, a drive is a page, is a formatted page blob. So you could create a page blob for each of your users and format it as a NTFS VHD, and you could actually have a formatted NTFS VHD and mount it per user that way, if I understood your scenario right. We can talk maybe more. Okay, so tables. Tables, the focus of these tables is to provide massively scalable structured storage. Okay, so you can think of having tables potentially of billions of entities, terabytes or tens of terabytes in size, tables. And the programming interface we have this is via the WCF data services. It was originally called ADO.NET. And so you can use .NET classes as well as Link to basically access your tables. And you also can use REST via the WCF data services to also access this with any programmer language. So shown here are the data abstractions where you have your storage account. And with your storage inside there, you can create many tables. Shown here for our storage account, we have a table of customers and a table of line photos. And then we store entities, or you can think of these as rows, inside of the table. So for example, for our customers' entities, we may have some properties like the customer name, email, et cetera. Okay. Now, for these properties that you're creating on these and entities, these entities can actually store up to 255 properties. And the mandatory properties for every entity is a partition key and row key. And these two together uniquely define the ID for that row within the table. So these two together effectively create the primary key. These also define the sort order where all the entities are sorted by partition key and then row key. And row key within the partition. And then you have a timestamp that we provide, which the client then uses for optimistic concurrency. Then for the rest of the properties that you actually want to store, there's actually no fixed schema. So these are stored inside of our service as name type value pairs. And these properties can be of the following standard .NET types, you know, string, bool, as shown there. Okay. So what I'm going to do is dive into this notion of partition key in a little bit more detail, since this is, you know, very important. Okay. Every table has a partition key, and you can sort of think of this as the first column of your table. Okay. Now, what we do is we actually group all of your entities based upon this partition key in what we call table partitions. So all the entities in the table with the same partition key value are grouped into a table partition, and then the row key within that partition provides a unique, you know, sort order as well as ID of those entities within that partition. And we expose this partition key to the users and to the application so that you can control basically the scalability and the granularity of your tables. And let's just go through a quick example to show that. Or first go into some details on the partition key. So partition key is provided for sort of three main reasons, or three main things you can do with it. One is it sort of controls the granularity of the locality for your entities. So all the entities with the same partition key value will be accessed from the same server. So you'll basically get what we call, you know, entity locality. You know, they'll be cached together, accessed together, so you get more efficient querying over your data because they're basically stored together. Then one key aspect here for the partitions is that it also provides what we call entity group transactions. This allows you to do atomic batch transactions over up to 100 entities at a time, as long as all those entities have the same partition key value. So you can do a combination of, you know, batch inserts, updates, or deletes, or a combination of those, as long as they have the same partition key value. And that update for that batch will be done atomically. Either all the updates will happen at once, or none of them will happen. And finally, the partitions are extremely key for the scalability for your table. What we do is you have your table, and we monitor the usage patterns for your table across these different partitions. And based upon these usage patterns, we scale out the access of your table across different servers. Okay? And let's just go through an example. So here we have an example where we have a table of movies where the partition key is the category and the row key is the title. And we have a timestamp, and then we have some additional properties. And let's say this table is currently being served on a single server. And as you can see, we have some partitions here. We have a table partition of the action movies. So these are all the entities with the same partition key value, which is action. Then we have another one here, which is all the movies with the same partition key animation. So all the entities with the same partition key value are basically grouped into a partition. They'll always be served from the same server. They'll never be broken across multiple servers. Now, let's assume that the first half of this table is getting about half the traffic for this table. And from comedy down, you're getting about the other half the traffic for your table. Now, let's say this traffic is actually too much for this single server to handle now. So what we do is we actually break up the table automatically by monitoring this behavior into what we call range partitions. So we'll actually break this table up at, say, this boundary at comedy, and then we'll basically serve these two range partitions across two different servers. So server A now is serving all the entities from min key to comedy, but not including comedy. So from its server. Now server B is serving comedy to max key. Okay? And so we automatically break up your service across your table across these different servers based upon the traffic patterns that we are monitoring dynamically as the traffic changes for your application. Now, by exposing the partition key to the application, that gives you some interesting trade-offs to make. You could actually put all of your entities into the same partition, and that will allow you to do these atomic, you know, entity group transactions across those, but we basically won't be able to break it across different tables, different servers. But if you, let's say the other extreme is you actually create a different partition key for every single entity, which you can do. We support that for scalability. That gives us a lot of options to basically break your table up across our servers. Because every single entity has a different partition key value that just allows us to be able to break it up at any place to spread it across tens or hundreds of servers to meet your traffic demand. Okay. So in terms of the operations for tables, you could create, query, delete tables. For entities, you have the standard things of being able to insert, update, delete, query, and these, you have these entity group transactions for the atomic batch operations. So let's just go through a quick example of using .NET, you know, WCF data servers for, you know, programming access to the tables. So the first thing you need to do is create a class, and we're going to use our movies table example. So we need to create a class called movies to basically represent the entity we want to access in our table. And remember, we have to have a mandatory three properties, partition key, row key, and timestamp. So again, our partition key here is the movie category, for example. Row key is the title, and then we have the timestamp for that the client uses for optimistic concurrency. Then we have a bunch of other properties that we can actually specify here, since we have a flexible schema, and we can use the standard .NET types. Now, the last thing you need to do to hook this class object up into WCW services as well as Azure tables is to specify the data service key. And this annotation indicates to WCF that the partition key and the row key are the primary key for this entity when you're accessing the tables. So once you've done this, you're ready to go to actually use this object to basically put entities up into the table as well as to retrieve them and update them. Okay. So we start off using our storage client library. Again, here we're going to create the base URL. Base URL, instead of saying .blob.core.windows.net, it now says .table.core.windows.net. This indicates that you're going to access the table storage, so this will redirect your request to the table service. We then use our base URI along with our credentials that we created the same way we did for the blob example to create a table client object. Then we can use this object to create tables for our storage account. So let's do that. So we can say take the table client object, and we can say create table if not exists. We specify the table name, and this will create the table in the storage account if it doesn't exist. Now, the next thing we can do with this table client object is we can create a data service context or a table service context to basically access our tables for our storage account. So here we create this context object. And that's, we're going to use this to basically add an entity. We're going to add an entity called movie with the category action with the Whitewater Rapids title. And we specify the table name that we're going to add this to. In this example, you know, it's movies. And we do the add object, this basically adds this to our contact object in our client. At this point in time, it actually hasn't done the request to the table service. So it's not until you actually do save changes that it actually sends a request to the table service. Now note that standard WCF data services provides a save changes routine. We've wrapped that with what we call save changes with retries. So this is the standard save changes, except it'll retry up to three times, as well as does exponential backoff for you. Okay. Now that we've actually put up some entities into our table, we can actually use link to basically query over our table. So here we have link, link query, and we specify using our context that we want to actually do a query over the table movies, and this is the movie object that we're going to actually be manipulating. And for the query, we're going to look for all the action movies that have a rating greater than 4 out of, let's say, 5. Okay? Then the last thing to note here is we actually wrap this with our own Azure Tables as service query, as table service query. And again, what this provides is it provides a wrapping for retries as well as exponential backoff. But it also hides one additional thing, which we have, which was called continuation tokens. When you actually do a service to a request to the table service, you can retrieve up to 1,000 entities back at a time. And you get back a continuation token, which you then send back to do continue to your query. The as table service hides that underlying protocol. So when you do a for each, it basically does that under the covers for you. So once I create my query, this actually hasn't actually sent the query to the table service yet. It's not until I do the for each that actually sends the request to the table service. So once I do that, I get back a set of entities. I can now traverse over them. Let's say I want to update them so that, you know, all these entities I got back, or all these movies, I want to mark them as a favorite. So I then do an update object for each of those. At this point in time, remember, it's not until we do save changes that it actually pushes the change to the table service. So this is just updating the objects, you know, with our client. So then when I do save changes, this will then push the changes to the table service for those movies. Now, one thing to note here is that if you just use save changes with three tries like this, this will actually send a separate request to the table service for every single change. Okay? You can specify save changes options.batch. This will actually batch the requests together and send them as a single entity group transaction as long as they have the same partition key value, and it can do this only up to 100 entities at a time. Okay? So there's an additional logic you would have to add here to deal with the 100 limit, which I left out for the example. Okay? So in terms of some things to look at when actually using tables, oh, question? So for Bob's tables and queues, et cetera, there is a charge per transaction. If you, just going back here real quick, if you did save changes like this, this would send a transaction for every single update. And you charge, you know, that basically increments your transaction count for each one of those. If you do a batch, everything that's sent together in a batch is considered to be one transaction, and it's charged as one transaction. So if you actually batch things together into 100 items at a time, you got, you know, two order of magnitude cheaper transaction costs. Okay, so in terms of using tables, to get just go through a few tips in terms of things to look out for. One is, when actually using any of the storage client objects, make sure you set your .NET HTTP connections to greater than 2. The default's 2. So we get a lot of requests saying, okay, I'm trying to put a lot of throughput through tables, blobs, or queues, and, you know, I'm only getting a couple requests at a time going out. And this is the reason why. So you typically want to set it to the number of cores you're using times, like, 12 or 16 or 32, depending on what you're trying to do. Make sure you use retries and exponential backoff. This is a distributed service in the cloud. These are provided for you with the wrappers of save changes with retries and as table service queries, so make sure you use those. Another interesting thing that customers may see is that because of the retries, that let's say you're trying to do an insert, you know the entity wasn't there, but you get back from your save changes with retries a conflict error. So what's the case? Well, what happened under the covers there is that basically the retry, one of the original tries succeeded, but let's say for some reason success never made it back to the client. So it'll retry again and find out, hey, the entity is already there, so it's a conflict, meaning, you know, it's already there. So you have to make sure that your application deals with this. Same thing goes for blobs, entities when you actually delete them. So if I say I want to actually delete this entity, you know, with save changes retries, basically the entity could be deleted, but due to a retry, you could get back a entity not found. That's something to keep in mind. And finally, one interesting pattern that we've seen some applications exhibit, which you definitely want to watch out for, is when you create a very highly scalable table, is append-only patterns. Okay? So, you know, we take your table, and it's sorted by a partition key and row key, and we break your table out across these different servers based upon the load that's coming to your table via the example in the description I gave. Okay? But if you keep on appending or keep on inserting entities using, let's say, the current timestamp, you know, in terms of the sort order, if that's your only partition key, you're going to keep on appending these entities at the end of the table. So effectively, you're keep on appending or inserting these tables just on a single server. Instead, if you could actually, if you want the highest throughput in terms of updates across your table, if you were able to insert in parallel across the whole partition range, then you can actually scale to thousands and thousands of requests per second. Okay? But you need to be able to to choose a partition key that basically allows you to insert across your whole partition range. Okay, so now to move on to queues, just have like 5 or so minutes left, so just touch on this really quickly. The storage concepts for queues are shown here. We have your storage count. Inside your count, you can create one to many queues. Here I created a queue for our winery to do order processing. And then inside your queue, you can store a message up to 8 KB in size, with maybe in this example, the customer order, as well as the maybe a link to some information on Blob or something. Okay. So what queues provide for your application is reliable delivery messages, as well as enable this loosely coupled asynchronous workflow between your roles. So if we take, for example, shown here, is that you may have a web role that's taking incoming work or work requests. And as soon as that web role basically inserts that item into the queue, it knows it can forget about it. I mean, it knows that basically that message is in the queue durably and reliably, and that a worker is going to be able to process it. Okay. So what this queue provides is basically a guaranteed delivery and processing of messages via this two-step consumption model, which I'll quickly go through. So after messages are put into the queue, the worker can dequeue the messages, and when they dequeue a message, they specify an invisibility time. This means that the message will become invisible in the queue for no other worker to see until that time potentially elapses. And so the worker has until that time to basically delete the message when it finishes processing it. If the worker does not delete the message within that time, then it will become visible for another worker to consume. And the primary scenario there is that the worker may crash. So the worker is working on a message, it may crash, and you don't want to lose that message. So the message will become visible again for another worker to consume and to continue processing. So just going through a quick example of programming this with our client library, you again create a queue client object using your base URI and credentials, and you can see here with the URI now is instead of blob and table, it's .queue.corewindows.net. So this will direct the request for your account to the queue service in the correct geolocation. You then create a cloud queue object to basically, from the queue client, to basically access a specific queue. So here we actually specify a queue name as the reference, and this gives us back a queue object to access a specific queue. We can say create this queue if it doesn't exist, as shown here. And then let's say we want to put some messages into that queue. We use the cloud queue message object to create the message, and then we have some content there in the message we want to create. Then all we do is say queue.addMessage. Pretty simple. Now, when you dequeue a message, remember I said that you specify this invisibility timeout. So I do a get message, and I specify in this example that I want the message to be invisible for 3 minutes. Okay? This means I have up to 3 minutes to basically process the message and delete it. So I can then process the message, and then I can say queue.delete message for that message. As long as I delete it within that amount of time, it's deleted from the queue. If I don't delete it, let's say the worker crashes, it'll become visible again for another worker to consume. Okay. And just to quickly go through the Q-tips here, your messages can be up to 8 KB in size. If you need to store something larger than that, you may actually want to store it as part of a blob and put the blob pointer into the message. Because of this invisibility time, and basically the concept of your workers could actually be restarted, you may be processing the message more than once. So you should make your messages idempotent so that you assume that a message could be processed more than once. And we try to provide a best effort FIFO, but because of the invisibility time and the fact that you're dealing with a distributed service, you should assume that messages that you put into the queue can be processed in any order. And then right now, a single queue is targeted to be serve up to around 500 requests per second. If you want higher throughput than that, what some services are doing are batching together those work items into a single message or into a single blob, and then putting that into the single message, the pointer to the blob or the multiple items. So if you put 10 items into a single message, that means a worker, they do have to process 10 items now, but you're getting 10 times the throughput from a single queue. And some of the services are just using multiple queues and managing them. Two things to point out here for in terms of functions, basically the properties that you get back for a queue. When you actually dequeue a message, you get back a dequeue count. And this is used for identifying, you know, poison messages. If you get back a message and the dequeue count is high, that means that this message, you know, is not being processed within the invisibility timeout, or you may be crashing the workers. So you may want to take this message, you know, put it somewhere else or do something differently with it. And similarly, we also provide the ability to look at an approximate count of what, how many messages are actually stored in a queue. And this is very useful to allow you to automatically shrink and grow your workers, for example. So if the queue is overflowing, you may want to actually add more workers. If the queue is basically always empty, you may want to decrease the number of workers. And you can do this dynamically via our service management APIs. Okay, in summary, I want to give you basically a high-level view of blobs, drives, tables, and queues, and show you basically how easy it is to program those with our storage client library. More information, you know, for Windows Azure, I'm sure you've seen the URL already. And there's more information on Windows Azure storage at this blog shown here.
Priorities on the queue messages?
The question was, can you set priorities on the queue messages? And you can't do that at this time. You could create potentially different queues with different priorities for the queues and then queue them and manage the queues that way. But, yep.
Can you put a message ahead of the other?
You can't basically have a insert order for when you add messages to a queue at this time. You can have many queues. So a few things I didn't have time to go into, but they're in some other talks that are on the web. For a storage account, you can actually store up to 100 terabytes of data. So you can actually create as many queues, tables, or blobs within that storage account as long as you are within that 100 terabytes of storage. Maybe time for one last question if there is one, but then I'm out of time.
So European storage, does that adhere to the EU privacy requirements? Stored in the EU country?
Well, we have a standard privacy policy that Microsoft follows. So we follow the standard policies that Microsoft does across the different countries. I don't know the exact details for that question, but you know, maybe one of the sponsors here would know the details of that. Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Brad. And while David's setting up his machine, if anyone has more questions for Brad, he'll be here. And for those of you watching online, I know we have been having a few issues with the stream. I am tweeting an alternative URL, so hopefully you can get right back on it. We'll have all the recordings available probably within the next weekend. Thanks.
Sorry, what's the question?
Slide.